Chapter 1. The more you know, the more you have to learn. The letter was short, sharp, and very much to the point. "Sir," it said, "why do you waste so much paper in your books? Who likes to read these pretty descriptions of Tibet? Tell us instead how to win the Irish sweepstake." The second one followed the theme very well. "Dear Dr. Ramp," wrote this brash young person, "why do you waste so much time writing about the next life? Why not tell us how to make money in this one? I want to know how to make money now. I want to know how to make girls do what I want now. Never mind the next life, I'm still trying to live this one." The old man put down the letter and sat back shaking his head sadly. "I can write only in my own way," he said. "I am writing truth, not fiction." So, fog lay heavy on the river. Trailing tendrils swirled and billowed. Redolent of sewage and garlic, it swept yellow feelers like a living creature seeking entry to any habitation. From the invisible water came the urgent hoot of a tug, followed by furious yells in the French-Canadian patois. Overhead, a dark red sun struggled to pierce the odorous gloom. The old man sitting in his wheelchair peered disgustedly around at the clammy building. Water dripped mournfully from some moldering concrete wall. A vagrant breeze added a new dimension to the world of smells conjured up by the fog. Decaying fish heads. "Pah," muttered the old man, "what a crummy dump." With that profound thought, he propelled his chair back into the apartment and hastily closed the door. 9. The letter thumped through the letterbox. The old man opened it and snorted. "No water tonight," he said, "no heat either." Then, as an afterthought, "And it says that for some hours there will be no electricity because some pipe or something has burst." "Write another book," said the people on the other side of life. So the old man and family old man went off in search of quiet. Quiet? Blaring radios, rumbling hi-fis, and yowling children shrieking through the place. Quiet? Gaping sightseers peering in through windows, banging on doors, demanding answers to stupid questions. A dump where quiet is not, a pad where nothing is done without immense effort. A pipe leaks, one reports it. Much later, a plumber arrives to see it himself. He reports it to his superior, the building superintendent. He comes to see it before reporting it to the office. The office reports it to his superior. He gets on the telephone, a conference is held. Much later, a decision is reached. Back it comes from Montreal office to the superior, who tells the building superintendent, who tells the plumber, who tells the tenant that next week, if we have time, we will do it. A crummy dump is how one person described it. The old man had no such delicate way of describing the place. Actions speak louder than words. Long before his tenancy expired, the old man and family left, before they died in such squalid surroundings. With joy they returned to the city of St. John, and there, because of the strains and stresses in Montreal, the old man's condition rapidly worsened until, very late at night, there was an urgent call for an ambulance, hospital. The gentle snow came sliding down like thoughts falling from the heavens. A light dusting of white gave the illusion of frosting on a Christmas cake. Outside, the stained glass window of the cathedral gleamed through the darkness and shed vivid greens and reds and yellows on the falling snow. Faintly came the sounds of the organ and the sonorous chant of human voices. Louder, from right beneath the window, came the music of a tomcat ardently singing of his love. The hiss of breaking tires on the snow-clad road, the metallic clang of car doors slamming, and the shuffle of overshoe-clad feet. A fresh congregation filing into the evening service. Muttered greetings as old friends met, and passed. The solitary tolling of a tenor bell exhorting the tardy to hurry. Silence save for the muted buzz of distant traffic in the city. Silence save for the amorous tomcat singing his song, pausing for a reply, and commencing all over again. Through a broken pane of the cathedral windows, smashed by a teenage vandal, came a glimpse of the robed priest in solemn procession, followed by swaying, jostling choir boys singing and giggling at the same time. The sound of the organ swelled and diminished. Soon came the drone of a solitary voice intoning ancient prayers, The rumble of the organ and again a glimpse of robed figures returning to the vestry. Soon there came the sound of many footsteps and the slamming of car doors. The sharp bark as engines coughed into life, the grating of gears and the whirring of wheels as the cathedral traffic moved off for another night. In the great building lights flicked off one by one until at last there was only the pale moonlight shining down from a cloudless sky. The snow had ceased, the congregation had gone, and even the anxious tomcat had wandered off on the eternal quest. In the hospital facing onto the cathedral, the night staff were just coming on duty. At the nurse's station, just facing the elevators, a lone intern was giving last-minute instructions about the treatment of a very sick patient. Nurses were checking their trays of drugs and pills. Sisters were writing up their reports, and a flustered male orderly was explaining that he was late on duty through being stopped for speeding by a policeman. Gradually the hospital settled down for the night. No breakfast signs were fixed on the beds of patients due for operations the next day. Main lights were extinguished and white-clad attendants moved to a screened bed. Silently a wheeled stretcher was moved behind the screens. Almost inaudible grunts and muttered instructions, and a still figure entirely covered by a sheet was pushed into sight. On wise purring wheels the burden was carefully moved into the corridor. Silent attendants stood while the summoned elevator slid to a stop, then, as if controlled by a single thought, the two men moved in unison to propel the laden wheeled stretcher into the elevator and so down to the basement mortuary and the great refrigerator standing like an immense filing cabinet, the repository of so many bodies. The hours dragged by as each reluctant minute seemed loath to give up its brief tenure of life. Here a patient breathed in stertorous gasps, there another tossed and moaned in pain. From a side cubicle came the cracked voice of an aged man calling incessantly for his wife. The faint squeak of rubber soles on stone flooring, the rustle of starched cloth, the clink of metal against glass, and the moaning voice ceased and soon was replaced by snores rising and falling on the night air. Outside, the urgent siren of a fire engine caused many a sleepless patient to wonder briefly where it was before lapsing again into introspection and fear for the future. Through the slightly open window came the raucous sound of a late traveler being heartily sick on the flagstones. A muttered curse as someone shouted at him, and a string of Hail Marys as the alcohol fumes made him retch again. The angel of death went about his merciful mission, bringing ease to a tortured sufferer, ending at last the useless struggle of one ravaged beyond hope by cancer. The stertorous gasps ceased, there was the quick, painless reflex twitch as a soul left a body, and the attendants with their whisper-wheeled stretcher moved forward again, and, later, yet again. He, the last one, was a man noted in politics. On the morrow, the yellow press would dig in their files and come up with the usual inaccuracies and downright lies, as ever. In a room looking out over the cathedral close, and from whence a sparkling glimpse could be obtained of the sea and Gotney Bay, the old Buddhist lay inert, awake, in pain. Thinking of many things. A faint smile flickered on his lips and was as quickly gone at the thought of an incident early in the day. A nun had entered his room. A nun more holy looking than usual. She looked sadly at the old Buddhist and a tear glistened in the corner of each eye. Sadly she looked and turned away. "What is the matter, sister?" queried the old Buddhist. "You look very sad." She shrugged her shoulders and exclaimed, "Oh, it is sad, you will go straight to hell." The old Buddhist felt his mouth drop open in amazement. "Go straight to hell?" he said, wonderingly. "Why? Because you are a Buddhist, only Catholics go to heaven. Other Christians go to purgatory, Buddhists and other heathens go straight to hell." "Oh, such a nice old man as you going straight to hell, it is so sad." Hastily she fled the room, leaving an amazed old Buddhist behind to puzzle it out. The angel of death moved on, moved into the room and stood looking down at the old Buddhist. The old man stared back. "Release at last, eh?" he asked. "About time too. I thought you would never come." Gently the angel of death raised his right hand and was about to lay it on the head of the old man. Suddenly the very air of the room crackled and a golden figure appeared in the blue gloom of the midnight shadows. The angel stayed his hand at a gesture from the visitor.
"No, no, the time is not yet," exclaimed a well-loved voice.
"There is more to be done before you come home." The old man sighed. Even the sight of the Lama Minutes Jayadondup could not console him for a further prolongation of his stay upon Earth, an Earth which had treated him so badly through hatred fostered and encouraged by the perverted press. The Lama Minyadondup turned to the old man and explained, "There is yet another book to be written, more knowledge to be passed on. And a little task connected with auras and photography." "Just a little longer," the old man groaned aloud. "So much always to do, so few to do it, such a chronic shortage of money, and how could one purchase equipment without money?" The Lama Minyadondup stood beside the hospital bed. He and the Angel of Death looked at each other and much telepathic information was passed. The angel nodded his head and slowly withdrew and passed on to continue elsewhere the work of mercy, terminating suffering, setting free immortal souls imprisoned in the clay of the flesh body. For a moment in that small hospital room there was no sound. Outside there were the usual night noises, a stray dog prowling about the garbage bins, an ambulance drawing into the emergency entrance of the hospital. Lobsang, the Lama Minyadondup looked down at the old man lying there in pain upon the hospital bed.
"Lobsang," he said again, "in your next book we want you to make it very clear that when you leave this earth you will not be communicating with backstreet mediums, nor ding those who advertise in the cult magazines."
"Whatever do you mean, honorable guide?" said the old man.
"I am not cooperating with any mediums or cult magazines. I never read the things myself."
"No, Lobsang, we know you do not, that is why I am telling you this. If you had been reading those magazines we should not have had to tell you, but there are certain unscrupulous people who advertise consultative services, etc., and pretend that they are in touch with those who have passed over. They are pretending that they are getting advice and healing and all that from beyond this earth, which, of course, is utterly ridiculous. We want to make it very clear that you are not in any way encouraging that trickery or quackery." The old man sighed with some considerable exasperation and replied,
"No, I never read any of those magazines, neither English nor American. I consider they do more harm than good. They accept misleading advertising, and much of it is dangerous, and they have such personal bias and such personal dislike of anyone not in their own little clique that they actually harm what they pretend they are helping. So I will do as you say. I will make clear that when I leave this earth I shall not return."
Reader, oh, you most discerning of people, may I have your attention for a moment? In fulfillment of my promise I want to say this: I, Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, do hereby solemnly and irrevocably state that I shall not return to this earth and act as a consultant for anyone who claims that I am so acting, nor shall I appear at any mediumistic group. I have other work to do. I shall not have time to play about with these things which I personally dislike. So, reader, if you see any advertisement at any time which purports to imply that such and such a person is in spiritual contact with Lobsang Rampa, call the police, call the post office authorities and have the person arrested for fraud, for trying to use the mails, etc., for fraudulent purposes. I, when I have finished with this earth in this life, I'm moving on a long, long way. So there it is, I have delivered that special message." Back in the green-tinted hospital room with a window looking out over the cathedral and with its glimpse of the waters in Gotney Bay, the Lama Minyadondup was stating what was required.
"This, your 11th book," said the Lama, "should give answers to many of the questions you have received, questions which are just and reasonable. You have lit the flame of knowledge, and now in this book you need to feed the flame that it may get a hold on people's minds and spread." He looked grave and quite a bit sorrowful as he went on, "I know you suffer greatly. I know that you will be discharged from this hospital as incurable, as inoperable, and with little time to live, but you still have time to do one or two tasks which have been neglected by others." The old man listened carefully, thinking how unfair it was that some people should have all the health and all the money, They could do anything and get on with their own tasks in the easiest conditions possible, whereas he had suffering, continuous persecution and hatred from the press, and shortage of money. He thought how sad it was that there was no medica in this province and how expensive medical bills were. For some time the two, the old man and the Lama minutes Jayadondup, talked as old friends will, talked of the past, laughed over many incidents which were not funny at the time they occurred but were most amusing in retrospect. Then at last there was a shuffling of footsteps as a night orderly went about his duties. The Lama Minyadonup bade a hasty farewell and the golden light faded, and the bare hospital room was once again in the blue gloom of early morning. The door was pushed open and a white-clad orderly just moved in with his flashlight forming a pool of light round about his feet. He listened to the sound of breathing, and then quietly withdrew and went on about his rounds. From across the corridor came the uproar and cries as the aged man incessantly called for his wife. Another voice farther down the corridor broke in with a torrent of Ave Maria's endlessly repeated, monotonously repeated, reminding the old man of some of the almost mindless monks who repeated Om Mani Padme Hum incessantly without a thought as to what it actually meant. From somewhere far away a clock struck the hours, 1, 2, 3. The old man tossed restlessly, the pain was acute and made more acute by the strain through which he had just gone. On the day before he had had a total collapse, and even in a hospital a total collapse is a matter of some concern. 3 o'clock. The night was long. From some where out in the Bay of Fundy a tugboat hooted as it and some others went out to bring in an oil ship waiting to berth by the oil refinery. A shooting star hurtled across the heavens leaving a glowing trail behind it. From the cathedral tower an owl hooted, and then, as if suddenly ashamed of the noise he was making, emitted a squawk of fright and flapped off across the city. 4 o'clock and the night was dark. There was no moon now, but suddenly the shaft of a searchlight wavered across the bay and came to rest on a small fishing boat which probably was fishing for lobsters. The light snapped off and into sight came a tug towing a very large oil ship. Slowly they ploughed through the turgid waters of Gotney Bay. Slowly the bright red light on the port side of the oil ship came into view and moved across the field of vision, to be hidden behind the old people's home standing close. Outside in the corridor there was sudden hushed commotion, whispering voices, the sound of controlled hurry. Then a new voice, an intern hurriedly roused from his bed. Yes, an emergency and the need for an immediate operation. Quickly the orderly on duty and a nurse got the patient onto the wheeled stretcher, quickly it was hustled past the doors and down in the elevator to the operating area 2 floors below. For some minutes there were whispering voices and the rustling of starched clothes. Then all noise stopped again. 5 o'clock. The old man started. Someone was standing beside him, a white-clad orderly. Brightly he said, I just thought I'd tell you there's no breakfast for you this morning. Nothing to drink either. Smiling to himself, he turned and walked out of the room. The old man lay there marveling at the crass idiotic stupidity which made it necessary to awaken the patient who had just gone to sleep. Awaken him that he could be told there was no breakfast for him. One of the most frustrating things is lying in a hospital bed, hungry and thirsty, and having just outside one's open door an immense contraption stuffed with food, ready prepared breakfasts for every patient who could have breakfast on that particular floor. But the old man glanced to his right and there it was, no breakfast, plain as could be. He stretched out his hand for a drink of water. But, no, no water either. Nothing to eat, nothing to drink. Others were having their breakfast. There was a clatter of dishes and the noise of trays being dropped and slammed around. Eventually the turmoil ceased and the hospital was setting about its ordinary morning business, people to go to the theater, where they wouldn't see a good show either, people to go to X-ray, people to go to pathology, and the lucky ones to go home. Perhaps the luckiest ones of all were those who had passed over to one's true home. The old man lay back in his bed and thought of the pleasures of passing over. The only difficulty is that when one is dying it is usually the physical breakdown of some part, Some portion of one's anatomy has been invaded by a dread disease, for instance, or something is being poisoned. Naturally, that causes pain. But dying itself is painless, there is nothing to fear in dying. As one is about to die, there comes an inner peace. One gets a sense of satisfaction knowing that at last the long day has ended, work has ceased, one's task has either been done, or, for the time being, it is being suspended. One has the knowledge that one is going home. Going home to where one's capacities will be assessed and where one's spiritual health will be built up. It's a pleasant sensation, really. One is ill, one is in the last stages, pain suddenly ceases to be acute and there is a numbness followed quite speedily by a feeling of well-being, a feeling of euphoria. Then one becomes aware that the physical world is dimming and the astral world is brightening. It is like looking at a television screen in the darkness, the picture is darkening, there is nothing to distract from the picture on the television screen if everything else is in darkness. That television screen represents the life on earth, but let the dawn come, let the rays of the sun come shining in the window to impinge on the television screen, and the brightness of the sun will make the television picture disappear from our sight. The sunlight represents the astral day. So the physical world which we term earth fades away. People look faint, their images look faint, they look like shadows, and the colors of the earth disappear and the earth becomes peopled with gray phantoms. The sky, even on the brightest day, turns purple, and as one's sight on the earth fades, one's sight in the astral brightens. About the deathbed we see helpers, kind people, those who are going to help us to be reborn into the astral world. We had attention when we were born into the world which we call Earth, perhaps a doctor, perhaps a midwife, perhaps even a taxi driver. No matter who, it was someone to help. But waiting for us to deliver us onto the other side are highly experienced people, highly trained people, people who are completely understanding, completely sympathetic. On Earth we have had a hard time, a shocking time. Earth is hell, you know. We have to go to hell for all sorts of things. A lot of children think school is hell too. Earth is the school of wayward humans. So, we are in a shaken condition, and the most people fear death. They fear the pain, they fear the mystery, they fear because they do not know what is to happen. They fear they are going to face some wrathful god who will stick a hay fork into some part of their innate mind and toss them straight down to old Satan who will have the branding irons all ready. But all that is rubbish. There is no such thing as a wrathful god. If we are to love God, then we have to love a kind and understanding God. Talk of fearing God is nonsense, it is criminal. Why should we fear one who loves us? Do you fear a really kind and understanding father? Do you fear a really kind and understanding mother? Not if you are sane. Then why fear God? There is a God, very definitely there is a God, a kind God. But, back to our deathbed. The body is upon the bed, the sight has just failed. Perhaps the breath is still struggling in the chest. At last that too fades, ceases and becomes no more. There is a twitch which journalists would probably call a convulsive shudder of agony. It's nothing of the kind. It's painless, or, to be more accurate, it is a pleasurable sensation. It's like shrugging out of a cold and clammy suit of clothes and being able to get the warm air and sunlight on one's body. There is this convulsive jerk, and then the astral body soars upwards. The feeling is indescribable. Can one imagine what it is like to be swimming in champagne with all the little bubbles bounding against one's body? What is the most pleasurable holiday you have had? Have you been on the sands somewhere, just lazing away with the sunlight pouring upon you and the sounds of the waves in your ears, and a gentle scented breeze ruffling your hair? Well, that's crude, that's nothing compared to the reality. There is nothing which can describe the pure ecstasy of leaving the body and going home. The old man thought of these things, delved back in his memories, and knowing what was and what was to be, the day was past, the day was endured would perhaps be a better statement, and soon night came again. In this hospital there were no visitors, no visitors at all. An epidemic in the whole area had caused all the hospitals to be closed to visitors, so patients were on their own. Those in public wards could talk to each other. Those who were in rooms alone, stayed alone, and it was jolly good for meditation, too. At last, a day or two later, it seemed an eternity, the old man was sent home. Nothing could be done, no cure, no operation, no hope. And so he decided to do as requested by those knowledgeable people on the other side of life, write the 11th book. And it is going to be answering people's questions. For several months past, the old man had been carefully combing the 40 or so letters which arrived every day, and picking out those which had questions which seemed to be of most general interest. He wrote to a number of people in different countries suggesting that they should do a list of questions they wanted answered, and some very good friends were made. We must not forget our old friend, Mrs. Valeria Sok, but the old man wants to thank in particular these for providing questions which will be answered in this book. Mrs. and Miss Newman. Mr. and Mrs. Yeti Thompson. Mr. DeMike. Mrs. Roadhaver. Mrs. Ruby Simmons. Miss Betty Jesse. Mr. Gravigan. Mr. and Mrs. Hans Smack. Mr. James Dodd. Mrs. Bean. Mrs. Van Ash. Mr. John Henderson. Mrs. Lilias Cuthbert. Mr. David O'Connor. The Worstman ladies. So the old man was sent home. Sent home. Simple little words, probably, it means nothing to the average person, but to one who has never had a home until fairly recently, until fairly late in life, it means quite a thing. Sent home, well, it means being with loved ones in familiar surroundings where sorrows are not so great, sorrows shared are sorrows halved or quartered. So, the old man was sent home. Miss Cleopatra and Miss Daedlinka were there with their most serious manners to see what sort of strange creature came back from the hospital. There was much wrinkling of noses, much hard sniffing. Hospital smells are strange smells, and how was it that the old man was still in one piece instead of having lumps cut off? He still had two arms and legs, of course he hadn't a tail, but he didn't have one before. So Miss Cleopatra and Miss Daedlinka inspected him most gravely and then came to a decision. I know, said Miss Cleopatra, I know exactly what has happened. He has come back to finish the book Feeding the Flame before he is taken off to feed the flame at the local crematorium. That's going to come as sure as eggs is eggs. Miss Daedlinka looked very grave indeed. Yes, she said. But if he loses any more weight, there won't be anything with which to feed the flames. I think they must have starved him. I wonder if we should give him some of our food. Miss Cleopatra jumped on the old man's chest and sniffed around, sniffed his beard, sniffed his ears, and had a good sniff of his mouth. I think he's underfed, Dad, she said. I think we shall have to have a word with Ma to get him stuffed up a bit with food to fill out all those hollows. But no matter what Miss Cleopatra said, no matter what Miss Daedlinka said, no matter how good Ma's intentions, the old man was on a diet for the rest of his life, a miserable, horrifying diet, hardly enough to keep body and soul together. Miss Daedlinka rushed under the bed to Miss Cleopatra. Say, Clee, she yelled, you know something? I've just heard them talking. He's losing a pound a day. So that means that in 270 days he won't weigh anything at all. Both cats sat there thinking about it, and then Miss Cleopatra nodded her head very wisely, with all the wisdom and sagacity which comes to a little girl cat 4 years of age. Ah, yes, she exclaimed, but you've forgotten one thing, Taddy. The hungrier he is, the sicker he is, the more clairvoyant he becomes. Soon he'll be seeing things before it happens. Fooey to that. Said Miss Daedlinka. He does already. Look at the telepathic messages he sent us from the hospital. Still, it's good preparation for the start of his book. I think we'd better help him all we can. The radiator was quite warm and both little cats jumped up to the sill above the radiators. There they stretched out full length, head to tail, and went into the usual state of introspection before communicating all the thoughts of the day to the local cats. The old man? Well, the old man was glad to get in bed. He lay back for a time and thought. This wretched book, Suppose I have to write it. I have to live, and even if I don't eat much nowadays, I have to pay for what I do eat. So, on the morrow, he decided, let's start this book with the hope that it would be finished, and here it is. It's started. You are reading the first chapter, aren't you?